Well, it's October 26, 1985. Bill, I've made a lot of notes, and some of this stuff may sound like I'm reading it off, because that may be what I'm doing, but maybe there's some stuff here you can use. It's probably a lot longer than what you'd anticipated, but when I got into the note-taking and the thinking of it, I just had a lot of thoughts that I'd never really put down before, never really thought, actually, when I got to analyzing just where we'd been and where we're headed. So bear with me and take what you can out of the tape and just ignore the rest of it, I guess. Brush Fires had a great number of personnel changes, not a great number in comparison to what a lot of other bands have had. We've been fortunate that three of us have kind of stabilized the group throughout the eight-year history since I joined in October of 77 up with Eddie and Joe. But we've had several other people come and go. In October 77, when the group was founded, Joe and Eddie had been playing with a previous group, Pike Trucking Company, that had broken up. Joe on the banjo and Eddie on the mandolin. And through our mutual friend Donnie Lee, the three of us, even though we hadn't met before, got together. And I was playing a little guitar from my past history and doing folk music on a limited basis. Mike Head was playing bass at that time, and Russell Owens was playing dobro. Mike Head stayed with us only from October 77 until May of 78, and Russell Owens from October 77 till July of 78. Okay, in May of 78, when Mike Head left, we took on John Landers, and I'll have more to say about him in a minute. John stayed with us from May of 78 until October of 79, as well as I can piece together the dates. In October of 79, when John left, Gary Sykes came on as bass player and was the first member we'd had who really could carry a part on the bass vocals. Gary stayed with us from October 79 until October of 82. Jimmy Ross joined in January of 82 after the breakup of Bluegrass Generation in 81. Stayed with us that one season from January 82 until October of 82, when he and Gary both left to start their own group. In October of 82, we took on Elwood Suggins as bass singer and playing upright bass. He stayed with us for two seasons, October 82 through October 84. October 84, we recruited and hired Jay Richardson to take over the banjo playing and the bass vocals, and Joe Partridge moved to the upright bass. After having played banjo for the rest of the history of the group, he felt that he could contribute as much on the bass, since we had access to a dynamite banjo player, and Joe had felt that he'd kind of topped out on his banjo playing at that time. He'd been working real hard and hadn't made the advances that he wanted to make, so it was his idea. The rest, we would never have even suggested it, the rest of us, but he initiated the idea, and it seemed like a good one, and I think it's worked out. I go into a little bit of history and analysis, I guess, of as I see each of these periods. I know the format that you're looking at, and I've tried to tailor this and come up with some ideas of my own that may be of benefit to you. Joe, Eddie, and I met in October of 1977. As I said, we'd been put in contact with one another by Donnie Lee. Joe had played with Donnie previously in the Bullsboro Bluegrass Band, having helped form that group some 6 or 7 years earlier. The first thing that we realized the night that we all three, just the three of us, got together were that we had the potential to do some good three-part harmonies. I had never really done that type of singing before in a group. Joe and Eddie had experience, but I think they realized that while I was not very good at that particular time, that the potential was there. Three-part harmonies were pretty solid, and Eddie and I could both sing either lead or tenor, and so we had some variety there that we could utilize. I was not familiar with very many bluegrass tunes, having only been involved with the music for maybe a year. at that point, having been to several festivals, mostly the Bullsboro Bluegrass Festival in Newnan, but a couple of others also, I was only real familiar with the best-known tunes. So in an attempt to build up a list of songs that we could begin doing, we concentrated on the simple tunes that we were already familiar with. We were doing songs like My Walking Shoes Don't Fit Me Anymore, Old Home Place, Some Old Day, Crying Holy Unto the Lord, and some other standard numbers. At that time, early on, we were also performing some instrumentals, as many as we've done since then, probably, particularly because we had Russell Owens, who was a fine dobro player, had not been playing the instrument very long, but just a natural musician, and was very skilled on the dobro. So we were doing dobro instrumentals, dobro chimes, Faded Love, Pick Away, some of those things. But the real emphasis was always on the vocals, and we felt that if we were going to have a sound of our own, it would be vocal-oriented. Individually, I think that Joe, Eddie, and I all felt more confident and more comfortable with our vocal skills and with our musicianship. And that's not to take anything away from either of them as musicians, because while I was a beginner and had very little experience and was a very basic rhythm guitar player, they were both far advanced on their instruments. Joe later told everybody the only reason they took me on was because I could sing like a girl, and I suspect that's true because my guitar playing certainly was not up to snuff. At this point, we didn't have a bass singer. We tried to make bass singers out of everyone who came and went with the group, but we didn't meet with much success. So we still were doing basic three-part harmonies, although we would do Amazing Grace, and between Mike Head and Russell Owens, they would bruise, batter, and beat up the bass part the best they could. During December 78, we did our first show, some 2 months after we'd gotten together. It was for a small community group in Shenandoah, Georgia. I think we made about $125, which may have been overpaid for the time. Eddie had a small Shure VocalMaster PA set and about 6 microphones. We hauled it around in the trunk of his two-door Plymouth and in the back seat and wherever else we could tie it on. At that party, we did everything that we learned in our 2 months together and some things that we hadn't learned. I particularly remember jumping into Slew Foot just on the spur of the moment, and after doing the first verse, just drawing a blank. So while they'd carried a second break, I casually strolled over to the side of the room where we'd stowed our gear, picked up a songbook I'd brought along, walked back to the mic, finished the song, just reading the words out of the book, which may have looked planned and neat, but was totally off the wall. We did a few other shows before our first festival as a unit, but nothing of great significance. In May of 78, our first festival was Cobb County. We went on in the wee hours of the morning, and as you can imagine, played to a rather sparse crowd, as is traditional for 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. By this time, we'd branched out, learned some songs that we could almost claim as our own. Two which were particularly well-received during these early years were the Amazing Grace a cappella version that we did, and the Civil War ballad that we took from the McPeak Brothers entitled The Last Time, and we had that was the first song on which we inverted some harmony parts using a baritone and a low tenor, both lower than the lead on the chorus. Of course, that's a style very similar to, or copied more or less, from what the Osborne Brothers and some other groups have done. We've used it several times since then, but that was the first real experimentation with anything outside of basic harmony that we'd done, and it was very well received. Both of those tunes were on our first album and probably among the most popular, along with Children Go Where I Send Thee. By mid-1978, both Mike Head and Russ Owens had left the group. John Landers was a friend and a fan who seemed to show up at all of our appearances. We didn't know any available bass players and weren't well established enough to have any knocking on our door looking for a job, so Joe suggested that since John had come to all of our shows, maybe we could just teach him to play bass and we'd have a dependable band member. John agreed to join, strangely enough. He and Eddie spent every night for about 2 weeks learning to play the upright bass, with Eddie instructing John in the basic techniques. At the end of 2 weeks, we played a show at the McIntosh Opry in Peachtree City, and with 2 weeks of training, John really came through for us under some tough conditions. He continued to work for the year and a half that he was with us, and his bass playing continually improved. Again, that's basically all there was, the four part. We didn't have a dobro player at that particular time. So during this period, we were back to just basic instrumentation and three-part harmonies. We concentrated on our vocal numbers, tried to pick up, locate, pick up, and learn some lesser heard songs to kind of set us apart. At the end of the bluegrass season in 79, John Landers left to pursue some of his many other hobbies. He was almost a Renaissance man. He was into cabinet making, leather work, jewelry making, scrimshawing, muzzle loading rifles, knife making, and just about anything else that you can do with your hands. It took some skill and detail work. John was into it. Once again, we had no applications for the job, and nobody on the horizon to fill the shoes, so once again, we had a fan who had loved music and followed the group, always there. So we took a fan, just happened to be Gary Sykes at the time. He made a willing student of the bass, and Eddie dusted off his short course in bluegrass bass, and soon Gary was the newest and the fourth member of Brush Fire Bluegrass Band. He had a great deal of want to. And for the first time, he also had some skill in singing bass. He didn't have a lot of experience in it, but he could hear a harmony line, and with a little help, could add the fourth part to the harmonies. It was a little rough around the edges at first, but it was a good start, better than what we'd had, and very much what we were wanting to work towards, so we were proud to have him. With this newfound bass singer, we became more intent on establishing what we could call our own sound, because as I've said, we were all gospel oriented and had always wanted to have a four-part quartet, and that was our ultimate goal. We just had not been able to achieve it up until this point. About 3 years into the group, we learned several new a cappella songs to follow up Amazing Grace. We learned Children Go Where I Send Thee, In the Land Where No Cabins Fall, Just Like Heaven. The moving parts of these latter two gave us a lot of difficulty. We'd almost have fights in working them out. But we gained a certain confidence in our vocal abilities, and we knew we could work them out with just some work. And so we managed to get them worked up to a state where they were decent enough to go on stage. Around this time, we'd been getting more and more compliments on the harmonies. It was not at all unusual for someone that we didn't know, just a stranger in the crowd, to look us up after a show and comment on how strong the harmonies were. So that just encouraged us more to work on those harmonies and to come up with songs where we could show them off. To begin with, we were a little suspicious that these were left-handed compliments, and they meant that our picking was no good. And we tried to work on that. We soon realize that the majority of people at a bluegrass festival don't really understand the technical aspects of playing an instrument after you reach a certain level of capability. But what they can do, the majority of them, is readily differentiate qualities of vocal harmonies. So we were pleased that that at least was our strong suit, and so we continued to pursue it. For the first time since we'd had this band, we felt that we had a solid lineup. We felt that we had confidence in each other, knew that all of us were dedicated to the music and to the band and basically to each other. And so we expected not to have any more personnel changes and tried to go forward. For 3 years, we had no personnel changes, and we could concentrate on the music. The stability and the confidence that we had allowed us to branch out, bring some songs to the group which were more complicated, some more contemporary numbers. We even had a period when we were trying to replicate the vocal styles of the group we admired, particularly Doyle Lawson and Quicksilver. This was during their quick rise to fame among bluegrass crowds, and of course they were doing the hottest and the best stuff vocally and instrumentally, but we singled out their vocal arrangements and decided that if we could replicate some of those things that we would have achieved something. So we knew we couldn't create our own sound by copying others, but we were trying some new things, just as they were. effort to find what our limitations were, I think, and maybe to gain some additional confidence in ourselves. During this period, the crowd response was greatly improved, particularly with the four-part gospel songs, the a cappella songs, and some of the slow stuff that we were doing. And we were discovering what we think the fans really will react to. We were also performing some new and contemporary songs, but for the best crowd response, we would always come back to the strongest vocal numbers, particularly the gospel and the a cappella. At one point, we even went so far afield as to learn a song by Leo Kottke named Louise, which was about Lady of the Evening, if you will. And after several performances of that particular song and no crowd appreciation whatsoever, we just let Louise pass on away. Shows were mostly traditional bluegrass with an occasional contemporary tune thrown in, always heavy on the gospel, and always as the final song of a set. It was just standard. We would use a strong four-part a cappella gospel tune. That was just traditional, still is, and if I have my way, and I think the other guys agree, it'll always be traditional that we close either with a very strong gospel or with an a cappella number. We had a tendency to work out some unusual endings for some of the slow tunes and talked about patenting this brush fire ending. It was during this period that we did the first album. We recorded, I believe it was in early 81, we recorded an album which we entitled Joe Eddy, Mike, and Gary. It's kind of a personal touch, we thought at the time. We recorded it in Newnan, Georgia at Jasmine Studios. We were happy with it at the time. After we got the pressings back and listened to it, we realized that the producers had dressed it up a little too much, put too much effects, and jazzed it up too much for a bluegrass album. It should have been done a little more straightforward. There was a lot of reverb on it and things that we wished hadn't been, but that was a learning experience. Looking at our bookings during this period, Gary Sykes, a lot of things you could say about him, but the best one is that he was just a born salesman. He took over part of the bookings for the group and was able to sell us in some areas outside of our usual circuit for the first time. We played Brushy Creek Festival over in Arley, Alabama. We played Uncle Tom's Red Hill Farm in Edgefield, South Carolina. And some other things outside of the usual Georgia bluegrass circuit. Later, in the last year that Sykes was with us, he got hooked up with Horace Bolton. And they together, with Horace's facility and money and Sykes' leadership, I suppose, began the World Series of Bluegrass Music in Jimison, Alabama, a twice-yearly festival, which has done rather well. For the very first one, the name of the band, Brushfire, was listed as a co-sponsor, Horace Bolton and Brushfire Present. That was just for the very first festival. By the time the second one rolled around, Sykes had left us, and that was his baby. We were really not able to do much with it had we wanted to, because the great distance from our homes and our band location and where the festival was, but we were happy to have our name associated with it for the first year and help for promotional value. During Gary's last few months with the group, he devoted most of his energies to the festival and less to the group. It became obvious that his future was somewhere other than with Brushfire. As it turns out, he and Jimmy Ross had already made plans to start their own group sometime during 82, and they were playing out the season. But let me back up on Jimmy Ross. In early 1982, Ross joined the group on dobro. Sykes had recruited him. Ross is probably the best dobro player in this part of the country, having played several years for Bluegrass Generation. Really good dobroist. With this addition, we again set about focusing some emphasis on instrumentals in order to utilize Ross's skills and give ourselves a little more variety. We did perform several instrumentals during the period, but they were never really featured parts of the shows. And for the most part, Ross just provided some really beautiful backup work and some good breaks to the vocal numbers. Toward the end of Sykes' stay, He decided to switch to an electric bass as an experiment. It was something that he wanted to do. The rest of us were a little leery about it, but trying to give each other all the freedom that we could, we agreed to go with it. And that was about the last 2 months or so of his stay. And by the time he and Ross left the group in October of 82 to form their own group, the rest of us had decided that experiment was over and we were ready to return to the acoustic bass. Just didn't feel that the sound of the electric bass did for the group what we wanted to do. It really stood out, and we were not very happy with it. Well, with the loss of Sykes and Ross, fall of 83 found us again bassless. But we were a little better prepared this time, for we had known about their leaving for a while. And for some time, well-known bluegrass character, I guess, Elwood P. Suggins, had been a good friend of the group and on several occasions would come on stage with us and sing bass on some of the quartet numbers in Gary's place. We liked the stronger style of his bass singing, obviously, than what we were accustomed to. So at Cobb County in October of 82, make a correction here on my notes. Fall of 82, we convinced Suggins to join the group. He consented only to give it a try for 1 year at a time. Having already been advised that Sykes and Ross were leaving, we just talked with them, made the switch there at Cobb County on Saturday afternoon. And on Saturday night, the new edition of Brush Fire was unveiled with Joe and Eddie, and me and Elwood went on stage with just a guitar, performed an all a cappella show. Elwood had been playing bass, been picking up some chords and things for a while, but really wasn't up to playing an entire show of stuff that he wasn't familiar with. So our only choice, and as it turned out, I think it was a good one, was to go on stage and just do an a cappella show. So we spent Saturday afternoon teaching him words that he didn't already know, cleaning up the harmonies, and shows was a success. I think got a real good response, and this chapter was underway. Suggins lived a long ways from the group. He lived well, 100 miles or so, close to that from the rest of us. But Eddie and Elwood got together regularly over the next few weeks for some marathon bass lessons, and once again, Eddie had trained another bass player for the bluegrass crowd, and Elwood became a member of the group. The merger of Brushfire with the character of Suggins turned out to be a very popular one, I think. We kind of united both fans, both crowds of followers. And again, we were back to a point where the instrumentals were playing second fiddle to the vocals, which I think were stronger than ever. During most of this period, the band was very comfortable with themselves, what they were doing, and with the place they'd made for themselves in the bluegrass community here. The type of songs and the style changed somewhat, I think, because Suggins was a very strong personality, very strong bass singer, and he brought with him a great knowledge of traditional bluegrass, particularly old gospel bluegrass, which the rest of us really weren't that familiar with. And this proved to be a great asset. We started learning a lot of traditional numbers, a lot of old gospel numbers, and just things kind of grew and snowballed in that direction. And as a result, we came out with, in 84, an all gospel album. I think a lot of people felt that Suggins had an undue influence on the group and had led us strictly into gospel music. It was not really a conscious thing. He was a strong motivator, but Eddie and Joe and I were all had backgrounds in gospel music and had always favored it over the other types of bluegrass. So it was not a difficult transition for us to make. It was not our intent to become strictly a gospel group, although since that was getting the best response at the time and we were having the most fun doing it, and we were also coming up with good, better original gospel material, things just kind of went in that direction. think it was during this period we made our largest strides in reaching out to new audiences and playing in new areas. Seguins had a good friend, J.R. McCoy, who was living just outside of Nashville, Tennessee. So during the first winter that he was with us, we just scheduled a weekend trip for some R&R to get the band away and go to Nashville. A couple of us had never been there and some things that we wanted to see and do. So we traveled up and stayed with J.R. McCoy in Tennessee for a few days, for a weekend actually. Went by the Country Music Hall of Fame and went by the old Ryman Auditorium, where we just couldn't resist the opportunity after paying our dollar to tour the old Ryman. Standing on that stage there where everybody who was anybody had stood and doing an a cappella song. Well, after we did the first one, totally unsolicited, the staff there at the Ryman brought out a single microphone, stood it on the old WSM stand there, and turned on the house PA system, which they'd used for tours and things, and encouraged us. So we stood around and sang every a cappella song we knew, I guess, and maybe some of them twice on stage at the old Ryman Auditorium. And that was quite a thrill for us. That night, we had planned to go to the world-famous Station Inn. The boys from Indiana were playing, and we had not had an opportunity to hear them before. They put on what we thought was the best show we'd ever seen anywhere, bar none. It kind of inspired us. And during one of their breaks, Ted had gone up and asked J.T. Gray, I believe, about us going on and doing just a couple of numbers during the intermission. What Ted hadn't realized was that we hadn't even brought our instruments with us. So we got up, not wanting to miss that opportunity, and J.T. encouraged us. We got up and did a few a cappella songs for the people there and were pretty well received. That was 1983. Crowd responses were getting better, and we began looking for festivals outside of our regular circuit to play. Bill Atkinson, who's a well-known album vendor and more recently a festival organizer and MC for some festivals, put us in touch with the Berry Blossom Festival in Lake Butler, Florida, which was just getting off the ground. Some real nice people, Mr. Tillman and Miss Clara Richards. And we worked a deal with them to come down and play their festival in 83. From there, we booked a festival over in Lawley, Florida for later that year, which was the first show that we had been on where Bill Monroe was also on the show, and that was quite a thrill for us. Through some friends of the boys from Indiana that we had met at the Station Inn in Nashville, we booked a festival down in St. George, Georgia, which may as well be Florida. And got quite a good response down there to a large crowd of people. The bookings were improving, the crowd response was getting better, and we were trying to concentrate on giving the people what they seemed to respond to best. The Lawley Festival in Florida in October of 84, as I've said, was the first appearance that we've had on the same bill with Bill Monroe. We have done shows with virtually every professional bluegrass band on the circuit at some time or another, and I've had the privilege to meet most of those people and spend some time talking with them. But, of course, playing on the show with Bill Monroe is the highest and best. From the Lawley show that we did, word was passed to the promoters of the Kissimmee Bluegrass Festival down in Central Florida. And in March of 85, we appeared at that festival, again on the same card with Bill Monroe. Between those two festivals, actually the festival in Lawley was the last festival that Suggins did with us. We'd had 2 good years, hectic schedules and long trips. Suggins had agreed to sign on a year at a time, and in October of 84 he left the group. During his tenure, I think we had gained greatly in popularity. We definitely spread our geographic bounds. We had recorded our second album, which was the all-gospel album, Way Down Deep in My Soul, which was an old traditional gospel tune, but Bill Monroe had recorded it many, many years before, and one appropriately that Suggins had brought to the group. We had become very comfortable in our basic vocal skills, and I think one of the most important evolution that I see changes in the group is that during this period, I think we all began to put more emphasis, more feeling, and more dynamics into the vocals that we were doing. We were more comfortable with the technical aspects and felt comfortable doing this. During the period that Suggins was with us, a couple of other highlights were we did an appearance on Georgia Public TV Tonight at Ferlinghetti's, which is a variety type show of musical styles. And more fun for us was going back to Nashville and recording 5 songs for the Carl Tipton TV show there on Channel 17 in Nashville. We went up, recorded 5 songs, and they were split up. One was used each day for a week as guest stars on the Carl Tipton show, and that was quite a thrill for us. When Suggins left, we didn't want to rush into anything. We had some ideas as to what we wanted to do. We did not want to make any steps backwards, and wanted to be able to go forward with the group at beginning at the level where we left off there. We realized that there would be a slow period while we got a new member and everybody got accustomed to it, but we were prepared to deal with that. We discussed what our needs were, and Joe, seemed like Joe's always the ideal man of the group. He had given it some thought and decided that after playing banjo for 7 years with the group, it was time for him to step aside and take over the bass playing responsibilities. He had this idea because we had already discussed the availability of Jay Richardson, who was living in Waverly Hall at the time. Jay was a bass player with a group many years before called Cracked Wheat out of Athens. But since that time, he had grown to be one of the better banjo players in this area. And Joe felt like he could be most useful to the group on bass. So he suggested to us that we contact our longtime friend and fellow musician, Jay Richardson, invite him to join the band on banjo and sing in the bass part. Joe would switch over to the bass and continue to sing the baritone. Jay had been with a group out of Athens called Southern Crescent for about 6 years and had sang baritone with them. We knew he had strong vocal skills and could handle bass singing. In fact, we had discussed that possibility with him the previous year, just in anticipation of our ever needing someone. We knew he was a strong banjo player. So after that discussion, we contacted him. He immediately agreed to sign on and give it a go. He'd been out of the music for about 2 years, or at least out of a regularly performing band since leaving Southern Crescent, and was ready to get back in it. So after discussing it, we decided to offer him the job. He accepted it, and we all had some discussions about the future of the band, the route that we wanted to take, and the type of music that we wanted to do. Joe, Eddie, Ted, and I had all decided that we needed to begin to get away from the label of being strictly a gospel bluegrass band. That was nothing that we had ever never consciously worked towards or thought about ourselves, but it was beginning to come back to us that that's how we were viewed by most of the fans, and that was good for us, and we didn't want to lose the gospel aspect of the music, but we wanted to branch out and get back into more the middle of the road. It was decided that we would maintain a strong foundation in gospel, but add to that sufficient secular tunes, traditional and contemporary bluegrass numbers, fast and slow songs, so that we could be comfortable and could tailor our shows to any type of bluegrass audience that we might be in front of. We've begun to do more instrumentals since Jay's been with us, and of course Eddie's a fine mandolin player, and I think we have needed to put more emphasis on that for a while. And now with these 2 fine pickers, we can do that, and they'll begin to receive some of the credit for the good pickers that they are. In March of 84, the first festival that we did with Jay, we had done a couple of barbecues and small shows around, but the first major show that we did, first festival, was Kissimmee Bluegrass Festival in Kissimmee, Florida, and that's quite an auspicious beginning for a new lineup. Bill Monroe was on the show, as I said earlier, And I guess that weekend, March of 84, we achieved what I'd have to consider to be the highlight of my bluegrass career, and I think the other guys would as well. After our Saturday night show, which was around 8 o'clock or so, we were backstage just mingling with the other groups on the show there. The Johnson Mountain Boys were there, and Bill Monroe was there, Bill Harrell, just a number of top-notch bluegrass bands. We were taking the opportunity to talk with them. When Monroe came in preparing for his show, he had his mandolin, and he was just playing little snatches of tunes here and there. He played an instrumental he'd written called Jekyll Island for us. He then started playing a song that he said he'd written but never recorded, and it was titled Farther On. And he asked us to try to sing the harmony parts with him, and we didn't know the words, but we didn't pass up the opportunity. We oohed and aahed and picked up the words that we could, and had a great time doing it. Well, we thought that was the grandest thing since sliced bread, so we were backstage congratulating ourselves still when a few minutes later, a guy came running around and says, "Are you the guys that were singing with Bill back here?" And we allowed us to how that was us. He said, "Well, he wants you up on stage to sing that song." So as you might imagine, we climbed over each other's backs in our haste to get on stage, and certainly not one of the great bluegrass performances of all time, but I think we performed as well as could be expected under the circumstances, and mostly had the opportunity to sing on stage with the father of the music that we're so proud of, Mr. Bill Monroe. Well, this is a beginning. 85 was a good year for us. We added several new festivals to our schedule. We played Lake Butler again a couple of times and made some promising contacts, which I think will help us out in 1986 and coming years. This winter, we're looking forward to a couple of things. We've been in contact with Roland White, Randall Hilton, who are regulars at Station Inn in Nashville, and we will be scheduled sometime during the winter months as a part of the Nashville Bluegrass Music Association Mini Festival, which is held monthly at the Station Inn to support the Nashville Music Association. We also have a festival coming up in November at the Holiday Hills Music Park, Laurel Hills, Florida. We've begun our third album, which is going to be the biggest project for the winter. We've finished four songs for that so far, which we're now sending out as demo tapes. We finished the Gospel Boogie, Old Flame, Diamond in the Dust, and our own version of Dixieland for Me. The album's being recorded at Reel to Reel Studios in Stockbridge, and our goal is to have it ready for release in April of 86, just before the festival season. We've got new group pictures and propaganda packages that we're sending out to a lot of festival promoters around the Southeast right now, in hopes of some new jobs for 86. As well as being a bluegrass band, Brushfire has what we consider to be a professional quality sound system for use mostly by bluegrass groups. Thanks to the 1981 addition of Ted Lolly to the group. In September of 81, the group was contracted to play two nights at Country's Barbecue in Columbus, Georgia. After playing Friday night, we left our sound system in place. We're coming back Saturday night to play. When we arrived back late Saturday afternoon, we discovered that Country's Barbecue had burned to the ground after closing Friday night and taking our entire sound system with it, along with a number of our albums, tapes, and virtually everything that the band owned except our instruments, which we had wisely taken with us. Everything else was destroyed. We had no insurance. The owner claimed no responsibility for our loss, so overnight we were out about $3,000. Knowing that we needed a sound system if we were going to continue, we immediately began shopping for equipment, looking around trying to decide what we needed. We didn't really have the expertise to know what we needed. During October the following month there, we were playing a festival up at Sugar Creek, Gene and Vida Cox's place in Blue Ridge. Ted and his wife had totally unfamiliar with bluegrass music. They had been friends of my wife a number of years back when Ted's wife and mine had worked together. They came to their first bluegrass festival there only because they were camping in the area and just out of curiosity and for something to do came over to see what we were all about. During my conversations with Ted that night, it became real obvious that he had a wealth of knowledge of sound systems and with just a little knowledge of bluegrass could be very instrumental in helping us with our search for a system. So I told him the story of what had happened to us and that we were currently looking for a new system. He offered his services in helping us select a system that would suit our needs. The following week, we all met Rhythm City in Atlanta, and Ted guided us in the purchase of what amps, speakers, cabinets, monitors, microphones, and mixer boards we'd be needing. And then, of course, we had a system which he thought was grand, but we couldn't operate, at least not as it should have been. So he offered to go with us to our first couple of gigs and teach us how to set up the sound system and also how to run it. That was 4 years ago, and he's hardly missed a show since that time. Hasn't missed one where our sound system was needed, and has hardly missed one where the band was playing. He goes with us on all of our road trips, and most anywhere we need to be, Ted's there. We quickly made him a full-fledged member of the group, which is probably an unusual move, but probably one of the smartest things that we've ever done. Under his direction, I think we've learned to use any sound system to its fullest potential wherever we're playing. He's helped us with techniques for working with microphones and on-stage control of the dynamics of a bluegrass group. And I think that's added a lot to the sound that we've been able to put forth. We realized that putting sound across to an audience was at least of equal importance than making the music. If you're making it on stage and it's not getting out, then it's wasted. Particularly with our type of harmonies, the sound system is important. In the past year, Ted has branched out himself. He's learned to play bass and is currently working on some dobro licks. So as for some additional variety to give him some exposure on regular occasions now, he joins us on stage to play some bass and doing a fine job with it. He's gained a reputation on our circuit, I think, as one of the best bluegrass sound men in the area. We're awful proud that we discovered him when we did. Our plans for the future are just to continue playing bluegrass for fun and very little profit, as it's always been. We are very much dedicated to the music and to the people who have put so much into the music for all the past years, and to the people who support the music by going to the shows and buying the tickets and buying the albums and things. As long as they're bluegrass fans, we hope to be providing our particular brand of bluegrass music to them. We hope to continue to improve, and we may experiment from time to time with some different styles, but basically, I think Brushfire will always be a vocally oriented group emphasizing a lot of gospel songs. After 8 years as a group, I think individually our love for bluegrass music is so deep that it's hard for us to visualize a time when we won't be playing bluegrass music, won't be involved in the performing of it. I think that time's probably a long time down the road. We take pride particularly in being a bluegrass band and in supporting and promoting bluegrass music. We've learned during our experiences that bluegrass fans will react to the things they enjoy. They're not going to sit on their hands if there's something going on that they're really into. The only barometer that a group has for its success or its lack of success is fan response. It's the only way you can judge how good or how bad you're doing. One thing we try to do as a group, consciously, is make it a point to spend as much time as possible meeting people at festivals, fans, talking with them about the music that's brought us all together as the bluegrass culture, the bluegrass subculture. I don't think there's any other top fan in the world that will travel the distances, endure the inconveniences, spend the amounts of money, and devote the time to their music that bluegrass people are required to do. Concerning other bluegrass bands, I think the most noticeable change in the bands in the past 8 years is just the number of new pickers coming into the music, and most of all, the quality of their picking. These young pickers coming along today are far advanced from what I remember in my early years in the music. I think each generation develops some new skills and advances the technical aspects of picking. The next generation learns from the last makes advancements of their own. Unfortunately, some advance the music right out of the bluegrass idiom, but others manage to improve and stay within the bluegrass framework. Bill, you were interested in... how's that for a long narrative? You were interested in everybody's occupation at the present time. Joe Partridge is a maintenance engineer for M&A Industries in Peachtree City, where he's been for about 4 years or so. Ted Lally is a construction engineer with Piedmont Atlanta Construction Company in Atlanta. Eddie Turner is in roofing supply sales for Healy Brown, Atlanta's largest supplier of roofing supplies. Jay Richardson is the director of public works for the city of Waverly Hall, Georgia. And I am a hearing officer for the State Board of Pardons and Paroles in Atlanta. There are several questions that you had asked me to respond to, or have some of the other guys respond to. I have discussed Eddie's mandolin with him. He advised that the mandolin he's playing now, 1974 F5 Gibson. He says he's played a lot of others in his travels, but he feels that for his style and for him particularly, the tone and balance of his mandolin suits him better than any he's seen. And he feels that in the past few years, the sound, his mandolin has aged particularly well, and the sound of it is really starting to come out with age. Question Joe about a couple of the points that you wanted to know. His musical background. Joe started out as a young person playing saxophone in a school band and started taking piano lessons. As I said, Joe started out, I think, playing saxophone and piano, took some piano lessons, but mostly was self-taught, playing piano by ear, developed a real, real fine style of honky-tonk piano. And Jerry Lee Lewis, one of his all-time heroes, but Joe was a real fine honky-tonk piano player, and from time to time during his career has played piano in a few bars and things around. He and Eddie had a country rock group prior to getting between his Bullsboro bluegrass days and Brushfire days. Joe got into bluegrass, he says, from Donnie Lee. It's just kind of a common thread with all of us, Joe, Eddie, and I at least. Joe and Donnie were both in the JCs together, and one night after a meeting, Donnie had a banjo in the car. And Joe got it out, and Donnie was playing him some licks, and Joe just got enthralled with the banjo and got himself one, got Donnie to teach him a few licks, and just went from there and turned into a fine banjo player. I think what Joe says, at least, is that country music, he just prefers the style and the sound and the themes of bluegrass music over the country music, plus the places where it's played are simply more enjoyable. Going to bluegrass festivals and shows is far superior to spending every weekend in honky-tonks and beer joints around the country playing country music. He feels that he can make a greater contribution to the group on the bass than he could on banjo. As history shows, had turnover of bass players regularly. And I think Joe's move to the bass is going to alleviate that, as we expect him to be around for a long time. It also cleared the way for what Joe admits is a better banjo player than he, made the place for Jay Richardson. So Joe doesn't feel that his niche in the band has been lessened any at all. He still is able to contribute in the area of arranging, and of course in the strong baritone vocals. Probably is one of the best baritone singers in the music. I'm sure there are some some areas that would interest you, Bill, maybe some of the things that you suggested that I haven't been able to cover here. I did speak to Jay at the last minute, only to find out about his banjo. He is playing a 1969 Gibson RB250 that he picked up in a pawn shop in Athens several years ago. He didn't have any particular remarks to be made for these purposes. Ted is putting some things on tape, and I've told him he needs to get those to you just as quickly as he can. So hopefully you'll have them in your hands very, very soon. Feel free to call with any other questions you have. If this tape brings up any unanswered questions or other thoughts, I'll be available, as the other guys will, I'm sure, to answer any questions or make any comments that you feel appropriate. Thank you.